You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hello and welcome to Bookworm. This is Michael Silverblatt. Today my guest is Alain de Botton. He's the author, most recently, of How Proust Can Change Your Life, subtitled Not a Novel, published by Pantheon, and the author as well of three previous things that are identified sort of as novels, On Love, The Romantic Movement, and Kiss and Tell, which were published in paperback by Picador. Tell me, the subtitle indicates that there's been some kind of confusion here. Kiss and Tell poses as a biography. I believe at one point On Love was published somewhere as Essays on Love. And so had you the fear that having been called a novelist before, the aspersions would continue?
Actually, the reason why How Proust Can Change Your Life is subtitled, not a novel, is entirely to do with the publisher and not to do with me. So that's a publisher's choice. I would have preferred it to be left up to the reader to decide. It isn't a novel at all. It is an essay, really. And I suppose it's the essay that I feel the closest affinity to. It's rather a sort of neglected genre because nowadays, if one's a writer, that being a writer means being a novelist, really. Or else maybe writing biographies. But I sort of look back to an earlier tradition of the essay, and that's what I'm keen to do.
Now, how would you describe, then, your own prose style? It's very clean, crystalline, but very jaunty, you know, conversational. Mm-hmm. Who are the writers? It's certainly not Proust, who begin to speak in this tone of voice?
Well, a model for me is someone like Montaigne, who manages to be conversational and yet at the same time, and often humorous, and yet at the same time, I think, also profound. I hope that when you said jaunty, that didn't mean can never be serious, because I think that I try and get in some graver moments, and I think the tone often does change from a rather sort of dry, ironic style to something graver. So I like that alternation. I like many French writers because I think it's the kind of style that one finds in many French writers. Stendhal, I like very much. La Rochefoucauld's Maxims, I like very much. La Bruyère, I like very much. These are the sort of people who've really influenced me.
So these are books about how to live, in a sense.
They are. I mean, I'm very attracted to books that will tell you how to live. I suppose that does guide my interest, a sort of psychological interest.
Now, many people would not regard Proust as being interested in changing lives.
Right. I mean, I suppose I would say that he once described himself as more of a philosopher than a novelist, and this tells us something very interesting and important about him. I think that his novel, he's not just telling a story. He once told André Gide that in his novel, nothing ever happens just for the sake of it. And he specified by saying, no one in my novel ever just takes off their tie. And I think what he meant by that was that he isn't just interested in painting a scene. Everything that happens in his novel is part of an intellectual operation. The title of the book, which I translate, I think, more accurately from the French as In Search of Lost Time, indicates a kind of quest. It's the quest on the part of a narrator to search really for how to stop wasting time. The lost time indicated is the lost time, not so much of sort of a nostalgic look back to the past, but the time that we waste, the time that is lost in various ways. So I do see Proust as having a very philosophical flavor to him. Some people have said to me, well, you know, you could have written How Dickens Can Change Your Life, or any novelist could have served. But I think what drew me to Proust was just how psychological and philosophical he is, so that his ideas seem to me ripe for exploration, that he is someone about whom one can write almost a philosophical book.
Well, What I mean by the question is that the Proust you describe seems to be too generous to want to change anyone's life. He wants to look at life, he wants to describe it, and he wants to give people a richer imaginative experience of themselves and others. But this is a man who seems not to be too decorous and respectful to change the life of, well, perhaps.
Right. I mean, perhaps, I mean, I'm sure that if he'd met you or I, he wouldn't have started saying, well, you must change your life in this or that
this
way.
This is not Rilke.
He was very decorous in that sense. But I think one shouldn't forget that in his novel there are all sorts of very definitive statements, like the only real life is the life of art. He's really sort of thundering from on high about the meaning of life.
It seems to me he doesn't in fact believe that life is very important. Art is important.
Right, art is very important, but I think one should look into that further. One way of looking at his novel is it's a person who's looking for the meaning of life, and then they end up in the last volume discovering that the meaning of life is art. Now, for anyone who doesn't create art, for anyone who doesn't write, that could seem like rather a depressing and rather narrow concern. He's really telling us that the only thing that person can do is art. When he tells us the only real life is the life of art, what does he mean? And I think that's something I was interested in looking at. And I think that he uses art as, for Proust, a symbol of all sorts of things. It's an area where all sorts of things that Proust values goes on. So, for instance, it's an area in which we see the world as it really is. For Proust, an artistic description of, let's say, one's holiday is a description where the truth of what actually went on the holiday is going to be conveyed, whereas the sort of false version is just going to be, the sort of non-artistic version is going to be hollowed, cliched, and in a way dead. So for Proust, art is really, I mean, if he was a philosopher, what Proust called art he would call reality, let's say. And I think that's the way we should look at it.
One of the things I enjoy in reading your books from On Love, which was the first book, to the Romantic Movement, to Kiss and Tell, and now to this most ostensible essay, How Proust Can Change Your Life, is that your own sentences have gotten more and more complex as you've gone along. And it seems to me that from the very first book there are references to Proust. When did you first read him?
I first read him when I was 18, fortunately not in an academic context. I think it's very important to be able to discover Proust for oneself. He has such a frightening image as a sort of great man of literature. I think that's very off-putting. So I discovered him just sort of by myself, discovered him in a secondhand bookstore, started reading him. It took me 4 years to read him. And I think Proust is one of those authors who one has to be in the mood for, and that's why I took so long to read him. But it always, he made a very deep impression on me, and he did seem to be someone who really could change lives, who had so many thoughts in so many areas and so many wonderful thoughts, that that I thought that he would make an ideal candidate for this sort of strange essay, which is half self-help book and half literary criticism biography. And because I'd always been attracted, really, to the idea of self-help books, to the idea of a book that could change a life. And so that's why, at some point, Proust seemed to be the ideal candidate to be treated in this way.
Now, in the final sections of Kiss and Tell, your previous book, you mention that it seems to you that because of the immense density of person in Proust's narrator, that he is less knowable than some of the minor characters who are known for one trait only. For instance, a princess whose only desire is to be kind. To switch tracks, can you tell, since there is a consistency here, what can be known about the narrator of your books?
About the narrator of my books? Well, that's very hard for me to say, because those narrators are sort of me, in a way.
Yes, it seems.
so I don't know. The narrative voice in my books tends to be, well, kind of a mixture of the melancholic and the humorous, sort of switching between the two, sort of lightly pedantic at times, a desire to sort of pin things down, sort of manically curious, over-intellectual, that kind of thing.
To my mind, I don't know if this will in fact help anyone, but it reminds me of what would perhaps have happened if Robert Benchley had attempted to write Montaigne essays. Montaigne wrote essays on lying and on different values. So what would happen if a humorist and someone who feels a little bit ironically out of the depths of moral seriousness were to attempt it? What would the moral serious sound of a humorist be who has to first express his befuddlement? Now, did some of that befuddlement come because the first book comes when you're 23 years old? And so a book of essays on love by a 23-year-old has to contain, to some extent, some self-mockery.
Certainly, I think without it, it would have been a disaster. But I think, I don't know, I never set out to write humorously. When my first book, when I handed my agent my first book, she went, well, it's really very funny. And I had no idea about this. And it's only nothing that I'd planned. And I never planned to be funny. It's something that occurs because I think of the material that I treat, which just tends to, and the way that I approach it. But it's not something I'm conscious of. And I think that kind of humor, I don't know where it comes from, but I mean, often it is a kind of befuddled humor. It's a humor of humility, which is really, what do we know? Often in the light of some great thinkers who think they know it all, at which point one can then come in and puncture some of the grander assumptions of these great thinkers.
The 23-year-old who speaks in On Love, and I'm speaking to someone who is now 28, so please
27.
Pardon. 27. But it must be soon 28, yes?
December.
Speaks from a certain perch. He seems to have been fed the works, the standard classic works of literature. When he quotes John Stuart Mill, for instance. You don't find this voice speaking of eccentric writers or of crabbed and peculiar and hard-to-find things. If you were to think immediately, say, of Proust's admiration, Ruskin, the voice here is not the voice of someone who's going down to the depths of the ocean to find the rarest pearl. There's something about representing received knowledge.
Yes, I mean, I suppose I do look to some rather standard authorities. I think that what makes originality is not so much the peculiarity of the authority. I mean, it's true, I could have dug out an extremely obscure parson living in England in 1650, and it would have been certainly eccentric. But I think that there's something that can be gained from saying, well, let's look to the big guys, the standard people, Plato, Aristotle, Proust, Nietzsche, whoever they happen to be, and firing some of the great questions at these people. Because after all, I don't know, in a way it takes a certain courage because there's a sort of intimidation. These people are so great. Who am I to start asking them questions? But that was also the challenge, to say, well, here is this great pantheon of literature, Proust. Let's see what he's got to tell me about life.
What I'm trying to suggest here is that when one first hears about Hélène de Botton, one might think here is bound to be a very eccentric writer. A Fairbanks, say, or, you know, someone who, Thomas Love Peacock, someone of the humorous tradition where the joke will be the oddness of the narrative voice. Yeah. In fact, instead, it's a very different kind of humor.
Yes. I mean, if there's any oddness, it doesn't come in the choice of people. It comes in the treatment, in the way the material is treated. It's the question. It's the way the question is fired at a great writer, rather than which great writer it is.
Yes.
So it's not eccentric. And also, I don't know. I'm wary of. I'm not wary. I think I have no danger really of seeming bizarre, because there's something that attracts me about making quite universal points.
Yes.
I'm quite keen not to go down any peculiar alleys, just because I don't know. I think the mainstream is something that, I mean, the mainstream in the sense of kind of the great writers, the great themes, are often left unexplored, almost because of a sort of shyness on the part of writers. So, for instance, to take Proust, there are millions of books on called things like The Phallus and the Symbol in the Works of Proust, published by University of California Press or any other university presses. Lots of very obscure things. There are not many books called How Proust Can Change Your Life, even though actually that's probably the question that seems most relevant. So some of these big questions like what is love and what is Proust about and these things attract me most because they're the way that these questions arise in my mind. And for me, the challenge is just to take those head on and to say, okay, well, why not me? Why not try and answer this?
Well, most of the writers that you look to are ones who would make wisdom become so relativistic as almost not to exist. They would say, you know, wisdom does not in fact exist. Particulars exist.
Right.
Attitudes exist. Styles exist. To what do you account an interest in wisdom?
I don't know. I mean, I think, let's see, we'll have to get autobiographical.
Please.
Yes. I think that for me, writing is a way of trying to digest and understand problems that occur to me in life, and not necessarily things that happen in a narrow sense to me, but things I'm interested in. I'm intellectual in the sense that I'll intellectualize things that occur in me and around me. And for me, writing has that kind of therapeutic value of being a space in which I can analyze things. And really, I mean, it's the old sort of project of the Greeks, which is to reason things through. That's what I identify with. And in our culture, it's a rather sort of mysterious position to take, or rather unusual position to take, because on the one hand, one has novelists who are interested in telling stories. And if you ask most sort of dedicated and mainstream novelists, they'll say, I'm not sure why I'm telling this story, but I felt I had these characters around me, in me, and I had to express them. That's not really my starting point. My starting point is I'd like to understand certain things. Here are some characters who are going to enable us to understand that. Now, that's sort of one of the great taboos of modern literature. One isn't supposed to start that way. That's supposed to be the wrong way to write a novel. But that's really my starting point and my interest, which is to try and kind of understand certain processes.
Now, in your first three books, the narrator grows increasingly harried. He's told by people that he intellectualizes too much, that he thinks too much about himself. In fact, Kiss and Tell is written as a demonstration of the art of not thinking about oneself, or an attempt to it. And it's almost as if in How Proust Can Change Your Life, the present book by my guest Hélène de Botton, published by Pantheon, the writer is sitting up and saying, well, you may accuse me of all these things all you like, but after all, I'm not Proust. In other words, so immersed in self-absorption that the cork-lined room appears, the asthma attack seems to be the reason for the long Proustian sentence, a sentence Proust himself could not read aloud without gasping.
Yeah.
This book seems to be to say, well, let's be reasonable here. I'm writing a parody of these kinds of intellectual snoops, but I am myself more interested in the normative.
Right. I suppose I'm interested in looking at Proust, who was a very eccentric person, and saying, even though he was very eccentric and even though some of his ideas are rather eccentric, what is there here that is more normal and that is more universal? And I think there's a lot. So that was really my starting point. And as for the past novels and accusations of thinking too much, I rather like the position of trying to work something out, refusing the easy sort of claim that thinking doesn't get you anywhere, but at the same time recognizing the limits of thinking, which tends to be rather sort of comic realization, or at least a sort of one of pathos accompanies the realization that actually we can't control and work everything out with our minds. And so I rather like that sort of dialectical process.
Tell me, many people have commented, John Updike among them, that these are works of a Gallic mind, and you've taken care to comment that you're Swiss and raised in Britain, but there is decidedly a penchant for the French sensibility, both in terms of the great tradition of the French novel and of the French essayists and fable writers and moralists. What drew you there?
I think it was purely a sort of emotional or writerly kinship. It was nothing to do with sort of spending my holidays in France as a child, or as it may have been, but I don't think so. I think I was just drawn to the sense of order, first of all, that one finds in these moralists. Just the table of contents, for instance, of La Bruyère's characters is for me sort of gets me going. It's attractive to me. You open the page and it has on women, on the court, on love, on death, all of these headings, and then it's sort of chopped up into little bits. And all of that seems very appealing to me. I like that kind of order. And I like the essay that tackles these great questions and tries to speak in a universal voice, because these moralists of the 17th and 18th century in France were very concerned with crystallizing truths in a universal way.
I'm getting it. So in other words, what you are is a 18th century writer on romanticism.
Well, or to quote Time magazine on me, rather more less attractive than what you've just said, I'm the Stendhal of the 90s dating scene. Now, I don't know why, what they meant, but this is what I've been called. I suppose I have a sensibility of the 17th or 18th century, and it's true that I'm trying to work out certain things. I don't think it's limited just to romance, and rather, perhaps, I mean, listeners might be muddled, what does this mean, romance? My mind, people always say to me, why are you interested in love? And then my mind always goes blank, and I think, am I? It doesn't strike me that way. So what are we really talking about, romance, love? We're really talking about human relationships. That's what interests me. And it so happens that the most intense human relationships are sexual relationships. But that doesn't limit, my scope of interest is in a sense broader. It just so happens that I've been observing human relations more generally within the more limited context of love relationships.
But what I'd like to propose is that, I mean romance in the sense of the romantic writers. Dr. Johnson didn't get a chance, in a sense, to reprimand Shelley or Keats, and that is the era of the invention of the self as the deformed, extreme, excessive,
right,
self-raging. And these books, in a sense, are what Dr. Johnson might say about someone whose spleen had become swollen, about someone who has now inherited the threat of suicide, is going to... all of these are correctives to excess.
Right, it's true. If I understand you correctly, what you're really saying is that in these books, I'm interested in looking at often quite extreme states, but my concern is always to try and normalize, or rather to try and understand. Our culture, modern culture, so much glorifies excess, books about drug addicts, fatal love affairs, etc., all of which, I think, as you're saying, comes from the sort of Shelley-esque tradition. The extreme person is the good person. There was an earlier tradition. It's not like these French moralists were always rational people who always knew exactly what was going on. It's just that when they came to write their books, what they were concerned, their vision of literature was an arena in which one would somehow try and order the mess of life and try and come to some balance, some rather wise and harmonious vision of how human beings operated. And I suppose that's still my interest. Not that I'm denying the chaos or the potential for chaos, but I don't think that's, for me, art is a way of trying to get out of that rather than trying to create more of that. It's a way of tidying things up.
Very interesting. One of my teachers, Hugh Kenner, wanted to write a book about the tragedy of Romanticism to be called The Shadow World, that this was the world in which things were no longer to be understood, an anti-Ezra Pound world, a world in which order could not be discerned. In fact, order was rebelled against. So these books are, in a sense, about restoring order, and you choose those emotions and figures most inclined to the disordering of the senses.
Right. Although, I don't know about... I mean, the interesting thing about Proust is that he himself shared that 17th, 18th century moralist tradition I mean, he loved La Bruyère, he loved La Rochefoucauld. Now, he'd also read Dostoevsky, so he's an interesting blend, but he's often spoken of as a writer who mixes the essay and the novel, and who, I mean, one can certainly read him in that tradition, stretch that wonderful French tradition stretching from Montaigne. And so I think he was interested.
Yes, but it's almost as if in Proust what he's doing is, given his romantic dissatisfactions, given his inability to find a soulmate or a helpmate beyond, you know, his maid, Proust retires to become the essayist on a level of passion he wishes for but can't attain.
Right, or rather, I mean, it's always that paradox. Proust had an absolutely catastrophic life, and what's interesting is how poised the novel is. The novel is not, he's not glorifying catastrophe and whatever. The narrative voice is poised, mature, intimate, wise. He's got a wise narrative, a classic French wise narrative voice that runs through the whole of Proust. And there's a sharp contrast between that and his chaotic life. And so I think that Proust is following that French tradition. And that's why he was attractive to me, because of that concern to find the wisdom and the balance with some rather difficult material.
Well, then I have to end with a very personal question about your own writing. You're living in an England whose novel has to some extent come back to life because of certain kinds of excess. I'm thinking in particular of Martin Amis or Will Self. It would seem to me that this is the kind of novel that you are writing as a corrective to.
Yes, I see myself as very much in a different school, and slightly out on a limb. I don't see many soulmates out there. I think the kind of stuff I'm writing, whatever its faults and whatever its problems, can certainly have a claim to a kind of uniqueness, simply because there's not that many. I mean, there's a lot of people concerned with depicting drug addicts in London. There's not that many people trying to understand why are we drug addicts and what kind of a wise position can we come to on this, what's basically a rather terrible thing. So most novelists are still caught up in that, what seems to me often rather adolescent, Shelley-esque kind of romantic bravado, and I do stand in opposition to that.
Now, are you then accused of conservatism in the novel?
Never political conservatism. I mean, in that, because conservatism often means that. But I suppose the accusation is, well, this is too intellectual, or it's not a novel, or this is really trying to be philosophy, or this is a bit French, which is the greatest insult one could ever receive from an English critic. It feels a bit French. So there's sometimes that. So I'm aware of sort of sailing some pretty uncharted waters in the British literary world.
I've been speaking to Alain de Botton, the author most recently of How Proust Can Change Your Life, published by Pantheon. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Jennifer Swadek. Additional production assistance from Alan Howard. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is made available to the public radio system by SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. Cassette copies of this and other Bookworm programs are available. For ordering information, call KCRW at 310-450-5183.
Books make you laugh and say, books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme. Now with Book of the Mouse, Pop.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.